Good afternoon. My name is Jim Woodward. I am the clerk of the United States District Court here in the Eagleton Courthouse. It is my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon for our special Law Day lecture. I want to acknowledge the contribution and support of the Board of Directors of the Judicial Learning Center, which has become the United States Court's partner in providing programs like this for public education and community outreach. We could not do some of the things that we do without their support, financial and otherwise. And I can't forget to mention the hard work of Rachel Marshall, who is an employee of the U.S. courts in this building, and it is her full-time job to organize and develop programs like this that contribute to our mission of public education and community outreach. So, Rachel, thank you very much for all that you do. We're going to begin this program this afternoon with a brief video clip. This is a trailer from a presentation that will be broadcast on The American Experience on PBS in late June of this summer. And this is a trailer from that production. Linda.
I don't want the nigger as I have known him and contacted him during my lifetime to control the making of a law that controls me, to control the government under which I live.
I don't think people understand how violent Mississippi was. If black people try and vote, they can get hurt or killed.
You're not a registered voter, you're not a first-class citizen.
They would say, you're right, boy. We should be registered to vote. But I ain't going down there to mess with any white people.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 students from all around the country who will engage in Freedom School voter registration activity and open up Mississippi to the country.
We face absolute extinction of all we hold dear. We must be strong enough to crush the enemy.
The three civil rights workers who disappeared in Mississippi last Sunday night still have not been heard from.
It was always in the back of everybody's mind that bad things were going to happen. But if you cared about this country and you cared about democracy, then you had to go down.
The Law Day theme this year focuses on the right to vote. This topic is now being debated hotly across the country for reasons other than what you saw in the movie, but it is still a topic that stirs a lot of different opinion and public interest and debate. Our topic today is to look back to 50 years ago in 1964, and to learn a little bit more about the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project. Every American needs to know this story. And I think if you know something about what these brave young men and women did in the summer of 1964, it might prompt you to ask yourself, what would you do to protect the right to vote? What would you do to help confront injustice? This chapter of the Civil Rights Movement teaches lessons that I think are still very relevant today. There's no doubt that the story of Mississippi during the civil rights era of the 1960s is moving and emotional. Some people were moved to outrage. They were outraged about the basic mistreatment of human rights and the lack of equal access to justice under the law, all of which were denied to African Americans in that state. The murders of Mr. Cheney, Mr. Schwerner, and Mr. Goodman early in the project in 1964 drew national attention to this plight. And for those who had any doubts, it certainly reinforced and provided absolute proof of the risk and the danger in trying to challenge the power structure in the state of Mississippi at that time. Some were moved to shame by the fact that Mississippi was known around the world as America's apartheid society, and that it was allowed to perpetuate that culture for far too long. Others were moved to pity for the deplorable poverty, the intolerable living conditions that made life so hard for blacks in that state. The poor education system can be pointed to as probably the chief cause for the lack of progress, the upward mobility for a population that was more than half of the state, and led to a sense of hopelessness and helplessness that conditions would probably never improve because of the second quality education. Others were moved to action. Our two guests today, Mr. Chris Hexter and Mr. Charles McLaurin, were among 1,000-plus young activist volunteers who in the summer of 1964 went to Mississippi to confront the powerful forces of hate, violence, and discrimination, hoping that they could make equal justice a reality for African Americans all over that state. And even though all of the goals of the project were not realized, Mississippi was changed forever. I had my own experience with Mississippi as a young lawyer. In 1979, when I graduated from law school at the University of Missouri Columbia, I was hired as a staff attorney in the Southeast Mississippi Legal Services Program, which was one of the new federally funded legal aid projects that were established all over the country. And there were five such programs in the state of Mississippi. And here I was, this fresh, young lawyer, moved to Mississippi. I knew not a soul. But I thought it was important, and I think in some ways I had an awareness of the events of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and it inspired me. Of course, I was young and idealistic and thought this was my opportunity to save a little piece of the world. So it was a huge challenge. Conditions were much different in 1979. I never felt fearful for my life. I was treated with dignity and friendship by all of the people I met when I was there, white and black. But I have to tell you, the poverty I witnessed in the year and a half that I was there was absolutely appalling. I would never have believed that we had people in the United States who lived in such deplorable economic conditions. And in some ways, rural poverty is the worst. People are living in remote areas where there's no access to not just community services, but to basic human services like utilities, electricity, and running water. And I visited my clients in their homes. Many of them didn't have telephones, so we would have to establish our appointments by letter. And then I would drive to them because they frequently did not have transportation. So I had an opportunity in many instances to be in their homes and actually see up front their living conditions. It was an eye-opening experience for me. One of the things that was slightly encouraging while I was there in the summer of 1979 was a general, it started with the primary election in the summer, the general election in the fall of 1979. They elect their governor in an off-year cycle in the state of Mississippi. And it was obvious to me in 1979, that the climate had changed for African Americans in terms of voting rights. For one thing, one of the candidates for the Democratic nomination for governor was a woman. She had been the woman lieutenant governor of the state of Mississippi, and she was now running for governor. And she made a very, very, very strong showing in that election. She didn't win, but she made a very strong showing. And then beyond that, it was obvious to me that there were lots of candidates for local office who were African Americans. And some of them, by then, 15 years later, they were veterans of the political process. And African Americans were voting in very large numbers, and they were electing African American representatives to all kinds of positions in state and local government. But it's fair to say that Mississippi is still a work in progress. It's an enigma in many ways, and much still needs to be done. As recently as today, I went online to the Jackson Clarion Ledger, which is the widest circulation newspaper in the state of Mississippi, and found a headline article that talks about Mississippi being the 51st in the state in terms of provision of government services. And the worst performing areas of government service for the state continue to be in public education and health care. And it contributes greatly to some of the conditions that persist in that state, even as we speak. It is an honor for us to have our two guests here today, both of whom are veterans of the civil rights movement, both of whom had roles to play in Freedom Summer. I am not going to spend time introducing them with a great deal of their biographical information because you have the materials and I hope you've had a chance to look at it, because what we really want to do is get into a conversation with them about that experience. So please join me in welcoming Charles McLaren and Chris Hexter. We're going to sort of conduct this informally with some questions that I'm going to put to the speakers, and hoping that you can all hear me. We will save some time towards the end of the program because I think you will have some questions of your own that you'll want to put to our guests. So let me begin by, Charles, let me ask you, you're invested in Mississippi. You're a Mississippi native. You still reside in Mississippi. Could you please let our audience know how it was that you first got involved as a leader of the civil rights movement and how you became particularly involved in the Freedom Summer Project?
Yes. Thank you, and good morning. I'm really happy to be here today and not be facing the judges.
As was mentioned, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi, and attend the public schools and got my higher education in Jackson. And in the 60s, 1961, the Freedom Rides came across the South, came into Mississippi. I was inspired by that group, people who came in, tested the bus stations, whites going into the colored sections and the colored going into the whites and vice versa. And that kind of got me thinking about trying to do something myself. I had had several, let's call it run-ins with the segregation system and the white supremacy. Way about the way things were being done. I had tried to go to the state fair in Jackson, Mississippi, 1961, and got arrested because they told me that that was not my fair and that I didn't, that it was for whites only. And I refused to leave. I was arrested. Medgar Evers, the state field secretary for the NAACP in the state, came and got me out of jail. And then some of the Freedom Riders who had come into Jackson and had tested the bus station, who were not able to get out of Jackson but got arrested and had to go to Parchment and other jail facilities in the state. The Freedom Rides were intended to end in New Orleans, although they were all arrested in Jackson and were never able to get out of Jackson, Mississippi, because they were either jailed, sent to Parchment. And so the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. Martin Luther King's organization, and SNCC, that had been born out of the sit-in movement, tried to organize an effort to get to continue the freedom rides from Jackson. So some of my friends took that challenge and got arrested. And when they got out of jail, we started to develop in Jackson what was known as the Jackson Student Movement. Dr. Martin Luther King came to Jackson and spoke, and the representatives of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee would meet with us, and we started to test facilities in the Jackson area. Then later, I was thinking about going to college and was on the campus of Jackson State University, and I was approached by a SNCC leader, a young man by the name of Lawrence Guyot, who later becomes chairperson of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. But he asked us to meet him one day at the Freedom House, and I did, along with a couple other friends of mine. And he told us about a project that was going to be opening in the Delta to register black voters. If you recall, the sit-in movement moved across the South, Freedom Riders. Now the strategy is to register blacks to vote in Mississippi. Mississippi's population of blacks at about that time were almost 50%, and that there were no black elected officials at all in any office except for a little town called Mound Bayou. So it was decided that we would open a SNCC project in the Delta to begin trying to register blacks to vote. So Bob Moses, our leader, the SNCC leader, came and brought three of us one night to the Mississippi Delta and turned us over to Delta leadership up there in the Delta. Amzi Moore, who was a World War II veteran who had gone overseas, fought for democracy, and then he came home and found that he didn't have what he had fought for. So Amzi, he turned us over to Amzi. So now I'm involved.
Now, Charles, we're going to get back to this in a minute, but you went to the Delta having very little familiarity with the culture, the politics, the makeup of that area of the state. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Chris, a native of St. Louis, graduate of University City High School, a lawyer here in the St. Louis area for 30-plus years. How did a freshman college kid from the University of Wisconsin end up in the Freedom Summer Project?
Well, before I do that, I want to thank you. I want to thank Rachel Marshall. I don't know if Rachel's in the room. If she is, this is a wonderful program, which I just discovered this year by being contacted by Rachel. This, just for people in the audience, this is the only district court, federal district court, as I understand it, in the whole United States that has a program that focuses in on this kind of thing, educating people about the relationship between society and law. So it's very impressive.
Thank you.
So how did I get involved? Well, there's a person in the room. He ought to raise his hand. Mr. Green. He takes all responsibility. In 1963, I was between my senior year at University City High School and going off to Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin, and a friend of mine invited me to go to a core meeting, a Congress on Racial Equality. In St. Louis, it was called Committee on Racial Equality, its chapter. First person I met, the first person who gave me any kind of education on civil rights was Mr. Green. And Mr. Green talked to me for about 2 hours, and it was a great education. And then, and I think the name is Lucian Perry, if I have it right.
Lucian Richards
had just come back from Mississippi the week before from Medgar Evers' funeral and gave an impassioned speech that kind of swept me off my feet. So in that context, I start getting involved that summer, which ended up, people in St. Louis know, in Jefferson Bank sit-ins. And then I go off to the University of Wisconsin. Well, along the way, I read a book called Mississippi, the Closed Society. It's by a professor named James Silver. James Silver had been born in New York, went to Mississippi to teach at the University of Mississippi back in the 30s, quite frankly, been there for years. And when James Meredith was admitted to Ole Miss in 1962, the only professor who reached out to James Meredith was Professor Silver. For that, everybody in Mississippi decided he really wasn't from Mississippi, even though he had taught there for 27 years, and literally he was chased out of the state. And he ended up teaching at Notre Dame. And one could say that was a pretty good trade-off for him. And he wrote this book about Mississippi, and it was just totally eye-opening. So now it's February at UW, and they're having a symposium. And Professor Silver is speaking, and I got myself invited into a little seminar with him. And I'm with 10 people. So he speaks to an audience of 1,000. The next day he speaks to 10 people in a seminar. And I'm listening to him, and I grab a napkin. Literally, I took a napkin, and I wrote on the napkin, "Dear Professor Silver, I am fascinated by Mississippi. Here's a little bit about my background. I'd like to go to Mississippi. Is there any way you can get me down there?" And I handed this paper napkin to him, and I thought, well, that's it. Well, literally a month later, I got a letter from him saying, "You will be contacted by two white students at Ole Miss who are underground working for the movement in Mississippi." And a week later, I got this letter. They told me about the Mississippi Summer Project. "If you go out there on the corridor out there, there's an application that I wrote, and it's on the table out there. It's the application that I used to apply for the project." I applied, got admitted. That's the story.
So you applied and were accepted, and then you told your parents, and they were thrilled to know that you were going to spend the summer in Mississippi. How did that go?
Well, you could say whatever your politics are, I was raised in a liberal family, and so my parents either had to eat their words or... there was a natural education. They were scared. They set up one rule. Okay, you want to go down and teach in freedom schools? Fine. Don't get near voter registration. Don't get arrested. Well, it turned out that summer, as we'll talk about the program, I was arrested more than any of the other summer volunteers down here. But I'll tell you that later.
Charles and Chris, when did the two of you first meet?
We met when Chris came down to open up the Freedom School, came to Ruleville, Mississippi. Ruleville, Mississippi had been my project since I got to the Delta in 1962. And we were all gathering at Fannie Lou Hamer's house. And we all got together that day. And then after a couple of days, I think I met Chris as we started to try to set up an old abandoned house as our freedom school. And Chris was the guy that they sent to set that up.
So I think it's a fair assumption that not everybody in the room probably has a complete understanding of what the goals of the Freedom Summer Project were. Could you, both of you, comment about what was the expectation, the tangible and maybe the intangible objectives?
Well, the Freedom Project was designed to do a broad range of things, but three major objectives around which we worked. One was we had been conducting the voter registration drive in the Delta, in the state. So we wanted to continue the voter registration effort, and we wanted to do something to try to help blacks in the Delta and across the state improve the quality of their education. So we set up freedom schools, and we wanted to challenge the Mississippi all-white Democratic Party in Atlantic City at the Democratic Convention in 1964. So we wanted to organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and get that party to Atlantic City.
Chris, before you were sent to Mississippi to begin your work, you went to Ohio for a training program. Could you tell us a little bit about what was conveyed to you during the training? What did they want you to know? What was critically important for the volunteers to know?
Yeah, the training was in Oxford, Ohio, where Miami of Ohio is located. The training was done at a small little Catholic school called St. Mary's College. And there were two waves of volunteers that went through. The first wave, which Charles got to meet before he met me, were the people who were going down to register people to vote or attempt to do that. The next wave were the people going down to teach in freedom schools, and do various other support activities to the project. So now, the first wave arrives on June 14 and leaves on June 20th. The next wave arrived on June 21st. So we were basically given a crash course about Mississippi. We were told what the risks were, which were arrests, potential beatings. We all had to go through a training program where we either were the BTs or the profes bitors. So we had to learn how to protect ourselves, not strike back. Some had to engage in aggressive racial threats to others so that we were, in fact, I was being trained by James Foreman, who was then the executive director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he was both having us, some of us, egg on others in sort of racial taunts and threats. And then while they were doing that to some of us, others of us were learning how to protect our body. Because I was going into the freedom schools, I was learning about Mississippi history. I was learning about the kinds of what I should expect in the way of the students, what kind of teaching techniques I should use, what the conditions of poverty were like in Mississippi, and dealing with the issues of Mississippi violence. And I'll give you an example, which is pretty interesting. At the time in Mississippi, there were only, statewide, only five African-American attorneys. Of those five, only three were involved in any way in supporting people in the civil rights movement. Because, of course, there were always threats to anybody who was engaged in any way in providing services to the movement. Well, one of those lawyers came to Oxford, Ohio to talk to us about dealing with what happens when you're arrested. Now, all of us were college students, and all of us were reasonably argumentative because we wouldn't have been there had we not been. And so his job was to tell us not to be argumentative. And his statement was, now, if you get stopped at 11 o'clock at night on a highway in Mississippi, do not think that you're going to engage in a constitutional law discussion with your local policeman. He is not interested in your views of constitutional law. And you had to learn that very quickly. It was a lesson in humility. And maybe in St. Louis you don't want to engage in that conversation with the policeman either, but you definitely did not want to do it at night in Mississippi. And so it was a combination of getting used to the fact that the law was flipped on its head. The law in Mississippi was arbitrary, abusive, unpredictable, and not something you could rely on. And particularly if you were a volunteer coming to that state, you knew that. If you see the movie, which was introduced here, you'll see how the city of Jackson, where Charles is from, was organizing for this onslaught. And I think Charles is, I mean, they had armored vehicles. I mean, they had this tank vehicle with, you know, like 10-inch plate armor for us. I mean, it was bizarre. And so the state was all, the Clarion Ledger, the newspaper, they were all freaked out by us coming down there. So it was definitely Mississippi was an armed camp, and we were being trained to go into that armed camp.
Charles, the leaders of SNCC had an overt strategy in mind in inviting the white middle-class college students to join the Freedom Summer Project. Could you tell us a little bit about what that strategy was?
Well, since as black people, we had not had any voice in the government. We had no elected officials or anyone in the state who would speak up for us. What we, and Chris has mentioned about Silver's book, The Closed Society, that's what Mississippi was. The leaders in the Congress and in the Senate was always given negative information about what is happening in Mississippi, that the black folks were happy. That we was living good. But then we knew that if we were ever going to make any real progress in education, voting, that we needed to bring national attention on the state of Mississippi and make sure so that we could then get our case heard by somebody in Washington. So the Freedom Summer idea was to help get about, bring about the openness of Mississippi. So unfortunately, the real publicity that we got that really opened the doors was the murder of the three civil rights workers down in Neshoba County. That immediately brought national attention on Mississippi. It forced President Lyndon Johnson to send J. Edgar Hoover and his people, well, they were already there, but to start to do something to try to find the young people who at that time was missing, who you later were found in an earthen dam after some of their own people in the area of Philadelphia told the FBI how to go about finding those people.
Chris, were students aware that that was the strategy, the reason for the recruitment of the white Northern college students?
I mean, to focus an eye on Mississippi, yeah. Yes. I think we were aware that we were going into a potentially violent situation. And I call it the deal with the devil. The civil rights movement in the South had to be based on a certain degree of confrontation with reality. It wasn't just be nice. You had to force a situation in which you were going to bring out, I guess what you call the bad angels of people who, if you did nothing, would not be bad angels. So, for example, in Birmingham, that's what Martin Luther King did. He involved school children in major demonstrations in that city. The view of Bob Moses, who was the one of the major leaders in Mississippi, is that without getting us, white students and upper-middle-income black students from the North, into Mississippi, Mississippi simply wouldn't change, that the degree of violence was so bad that it would just, you had to get the eyes of America on the state. And so that, we knew that, we were told that, we were told there were risks in doing that. So right from the start, yes, we were quite aware.
You've both touched on this a little bit already, but could you tell our audience more specifically, what were the conditions in Mississippi, particularly in the Delta, that prevented African Americans from going to register to vote? Why didn't they just go vote?
Well, the Delta was made up of large plantations, and most of the blacks who lived on these plantations were poorly educated, if at all. They were dependent upon the plantation owner and dependent upon federal surplus food during the off-harvest season. So economic and pressure and reprisals of all kinds were used to keep these people in place. Plus, the state of Mississippi had a literacy test that required you to make an application to read, write, and interpret a section of the Mississippi Constitution to the satisfaction of a registrar who was not lawyers. Many of them couldn't pass the test themselves. And you had to have 3 poll tax receipts before you could vote. Would have had to pay your poll tax for 3 years consecutively, and you had to, there was a good moral character section of this application, so that you had to, anybody in the community, mostly white, could challenge your right to be a registered voter. At the same time, the state of Mississippi was not adequately educating black people. In fact, education had been denied to blacks. So here they are asking us to pass a literacy test that was designed for the purpose of keeping us from registering to vote, from blacks from registering to vote. So there was all kinds of obstacles. and barriers. The boss man hearing about you down there trying to register to vote, you're automatically going to get some kind of beating. There were places, in my early work, a black woman told me, she said, if we go down and we try to register to vote, our boss man told us that he would whip us. And there was an article in Look magazine by the mayor of Ruleville, Mississippi, who was at that in 1964 was the mayor when Chris and all of them came down. And he stated in that magazine that if any of his niggas went down and registered to vote, he'd shoot them down like rabbits. So there were just overall fear on the part of blacks about registering and voting. And even when you got one or two registered, they didn't dare show up at the poll on election day.
Chris, Ruleville was an interesting community. You had never visited it before. You arrived and began work in the Freedom School that was established in that community. Tell us a little bit about what you saw in Ruleville and what was unique about that community.
Well, it was, I don't know how many people here from small towns. I know a friend of mine, Shirley Brown, is. Our family was from Charleston, Missouri, small town, but Ruleville's tiny. And it turns out Ruleville was the home office for James Eastland, then one of the most powerful men in Congress. He was Senator Eastland. He was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. His plantation was 5 miles south of Ruleville in a town called Doddsville, even smaller. Doddsville's like a dot. You have maybe one shack and then a town sign that says Doddsville. So you blink, and before you could say Doddsville, you're out of Doddsville. But that was Eastland's plantation. And Ruleville was at the intersection of two roads. They had the white side with cute little houses, nice paved streets, little Baptist church, everything nice and neat, stores down the main street. And then catty corner from that was the area where African Americans stayed. There, most of the houses were shacks. Many people could go to sleep and look out and see the stars at night in their shack. Many of them didn't have plumbing. They had very rudimentary electricity. Many of them didn't have refrigeration. None of the streets were paved. You had a couple sanctified Baptist churches. Again, in sort of what I would call larger sort of shack-like structures. When I got there, I arrived in Mississippi. It was about 100 degrees. I got off. I remember I was greeted by a woman who's famous in the movement, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, who Charles knew very well. And Miss Hamer was just a lovely person. So she greeted us, and she was in a shack. We had to guard her shack. And knew pretty quickly that I could look out of Mrs. Hamer's shack, and she would point down to the gas station at the corner. This was a warning she gave to us. She said, "You see those white guys down there? They all want to kill you. That's where the Klan all gathers, and they look over what we're doing over here." So I knew that there was potentially violence right around the corner.
That's a great segue to my next question, which is Fannie Lou Hamer, who was an icon of the civil rights movement. Charles, could you shed a little light on the role that she played and the influence that she had on you and others who were involved in the movement?
Yes, I'll be glad to. Fannie Lou Hamer was one of the strongest and most courageous women who grew up on a plantation, the granddaughter of slaves. In Ruleville, as the organizer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Ruleville, in Sunflower County, one of the things we did was try to hold citizenship classes to kind of familiarize the people from the plantations about a little bit about citizenship, a little bit about the literacy test, a little bit about the kind of thing that they would face going down to register to vote. So Fannie Lou Hamer had been invited from one of the local plantations, and she came into Ruleville to one of our workshops, and she was one of the first people in a class of about 20 to agree that they would go down to the Sunflower County Courthouse to take the literacy test and try to become a registered voter. In the county, everybody in the county had to go to the county seat, to the courthouse. Ruleville was roughly 25 miles away from the county seat. So Fannie Lou Hamer came to this workshop, and then she, on a bus, went to the courthouse to register to vote along with 18 other people. And when she left the courthouse and got back home that evening, the plantation owner already knew that she had been to the courthouse, and he challenged her. He said, Fannie Lou Hamer, you need to go back to the court. I know you've been down there trying to register to vote, and we're not ready for that. And you need to go back and withdraw your application to register to vote, or you'll have to leave. And, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer and her family talked it over, and it was decided that she would leave. And she left her two adopted daughters and her husband on the plantation because they were sharecroppers and they owed the plantation owner a share of the crop that they were going to harvest at the end of the, when the harvesting season came. So they did not want to leave their owing him because he could have, the way things were and the way the law were, they could have, even though it's against the law to put a person in jail for a debt in Mississippi, the law didn't apply whenever a white person wanted to do something to a black. So Fannie Lou Hamer left, came into town, spent a couple nights in the house with the lady who had invited her to the citizenship class in the first place. 10 nights later, night riders drove through the Ruleville community, shot up the community, shot into the house where we were staying, the SNCC people, shot into a house where one of the leaders of the SNCC, of the voter registration effort was living. Two young students from Jackson State University was wounded, shot numerous bullets into the house where Fannie Lou Hamer was staying. Fortunately, Fannie Lou Hamer nor the people who lived that had brought her there was home. And so Fannie Lou Hamer then left Ruleville. And about a week later, I was ordered by Bob Moses, who was our SNCC director, to go and locate Fannie Lou Hamer, locate the lady who was singing, who was brave enough to go down and register to vote, and bring her to a SNCC conference. This is in August, and this is 1962, latter part of 1962. And so I went to locate Fannie Lou Hamer. Finally, after all day driving and getting lost and in the mud, and finally located Fannie Lou Hamer. She was living up in the North Delta. And what strange thing about her, and listen to this, how she was. Now, after I found her, and they told me where I could get her, I knocked on the door to the little shack where she was living, in a plantation shack. It was pouring down, raining. And someone said, "Who is it?" And I said, "Mac Lauren." And said, "Come in." So I walk in. There's a big wing back type chair with the back facing the door and a pot belly stove. Coal-burning, wood-burning stove that was red hot, and there was a body in that chair. And when I said, "I'm looking for Fannie Lou Hamer," this lady stood up and said, "I'm Fannie Lou Hamer." I said, "Bob Moses, SNCC told me to come find you and bring you to Tougaloo College, where we're going to journey to Nashville, Tennessee. She says, have a seat, I'll be right with you. And she was always ready. She told, and all the way to Tougaloo College, 100 miles from the Delta to Tougaloo College at Jackson, she talked, told me her whole story of her life. And when we got to Nashville that night, well, the next night, then Fannie Lou Hamer was really discovered by the SNCC leadership, and because of her ability to speak and her ability to move people with her, the way she would take Bible verses and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and Daniel in the lion's den, and use those in a way to move people to action. And so they, Fannie Lou Hamer then was sent on a whirlwind tour, fundraising and talking to people in colleges and universities in the Northeast. And then when she finally came back to Ruvia, she just came right back and jumped into a voter registration drive. And then we just, by now we have been having meetings across the Delta. Fannie Lou Hamer is now a person who becoming some noted by the local politicians and the power structure. And we now need to do something to pick up from where she got into the movement and the shootings that took place that nothing was ever done about. So we decided to run Fannie Lou Hamer for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District. The Mississippi had 5 congressional districts. The 2nd Congressional District was made up of mostly of the Delta. And so we decided to, as a conscious raising effort, and to set up a freedom vote and run candidates. And so Fannie Lou Hamer was one of our candidates that we ran for office. And later down the road, we'll get into how she was a part of helping to organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and how that party played a role in Freedom Summer, and how we got to Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Thank you, Charles. Chris, you broke your promise to your parents to not get arrested during the Freedom Summer Project. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances, and then we're also interested to know, how did you raise bail when you got arrested, and did you have access to legal representation in those instances where you were jailed?
Yeah, I promised my parents I wouldn't go out and register voters, because their view, they had some view that was more dangerous. But I did make a decision one day to go up to Drew, Mississippi, with Charles and about 22 other folk, to encourage. I made this distinction. It's kind of like a lawyer's distinction. I wasn't actually registering you, but I was encouraging you to go down and register to vote. And so we go up to Drew, and Drew makes Ruleville look like a metropolitan city. So you remember Drew, Ruleville, small town. Drew, real small town. And we're on this street in this sort of, again, the sort of area where most black families live. And we're standing on in fact, I got out of the car just after hearing that Barry Goldwater had been nominated at the Cow Palace. So I get out of the car, it's right during the Republican convention in San Francisco, here he's nominated, get out of the car, standing on the grounds of this church. And one thing that's sort of tied to civil rights in Mississippi is singing. And like Charles mentioned, and Miss Hamer was one of the best singers of all. And a lot of the songs sort of relate to more to the Old Testament than the New Testament of the Bible, because it's all about moving from slavery to freedom. That's the central story of much of the first 5 books of the Bible. So, and so we're singing. And one of the songs we're singing, which was not biblical, was "Which Side Are You On?" And we were trying to encourage mostly the men on the other side of the street to do what Charles said would be very dangerous: come over the street and come with us from Drew down to Indianola, the county seat, and register. So we're there, and the mayor let the owner of the church grounds that we were on, the owner of the church grounds was not the minister. It was a white guy who owned the land, which the shack was on. And he said, and he calls him and says, these agitators are out there causing trouble. So the owner of the grounds calls the church minister and says, you won't have a church on Sunday unless you get those people off this ground right away. And so we were told we had to leave. We walked out in the sidewalks and streets of Drew, which were empty. The only thing coming down that street was air, hot air. And as soon as we walked out, a guy with two six-shooters and a belt, which sort of down to here, comes up. And next to him is the mayor, and this guy says, you're under arrest for blocking the sidewalks and streets of Drew, Mississippi. Y'all come with me. And so I was hauled off to jail along with 22 other people. The law part of this is, the next day, 110 people were arrested in Greenwood. And the strategy back then, based on a case which some lawyers may know called Dombrowski versus Pfister, was to remove cases from a legal system that was so corrupted and so biased and so hostile that you could remove the case to district court, federal district court, and then if you could prove to the judge, the satisfaction of the judge, that there was no way in God's green earth that you could get a fair trial there, they would enjoin the prosecution. Well, these two lawyers had to draft 130-plus petitions, and they lost one. Second arrest, me. And that day, I was driving a Catholic priest around Indianola, who had come down to see the project, and I'm driving him around, and the sheriff's car pulls up behind me. And this is the day that the three bodies of the civil rights workers were found in Neshoba County. And so I knew about that, and the sheriff pulls up behind me, and out gets, what's his name?
John Sidney Park.
John Sidney Park. Now, John Sidney Park was about 6'5" and 290 pounds. And his shirt, if you know, the guy is too fat for his shirt, the buttons are popping out, and he's got... He's the archetypal guy. He's got sweat under his arms, and he says, comes up to me, and he says, you, Hexter? And I said, yes. He says, yo, come with me. And as I say, you didn't argue with a guy like that. And I got in the car, and I told the priest, because this was the deal we struck. You always would let somebody know that what was happening. So the priest, I told him, go back and let him know. And I was taken back up to Drew. And the folk at the center hustled up a lawyer because they knew why I was going. They found out why I was going, which was I was going to be tried because my case hadn't been removed. So I'm going to get tried in Drew for blocking and obstructing the sidewalks and streets of Drew, Mississippi. The guy who tried me was the guy who arrested me, the mayor, who is now the Justice of Peace. And I had this high, fancy lawyer in the courtroom, and he was a very fancy, you know, silk stocking kind of guy who was apoplectic. I mean, he just couldn't believe what was going on. And he's trying to object and this and that, waving his arms up and down with his fancy suit. And the mayor could give a damn. And so I was convicted, sent back to jail down in by the sheriff and back to Indianola. So now I had to get out. Well, bail was raised a number of ways. If you had family, thank God I had family who, my father was probably cursing me under his breath. I'm sure he wasn't a happy camper. I kept trying to say, I didn't register anybody to vote, Dad. Just. But anyway, so if you had family, you could get out. And then the one of the key things is the project did get support from the North, so people were raising money to get people out of jail who were not. And as I say, I did have a lawyer who couldn't do me much good in front of the mayor. But there were lawyers who were sent down by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, which had been organized by John F. Kennedy. Because when John F. Kennedy pushed for the Civil Rights Act, he said, I need the best lawyers in the North to help create an organization that will make sure I can make a record on what's going on in the South. And then there were lawyers sent down by the Lawyers Guild, which was a controversial organization because left wing, was often attached to the Communist Party. And then there were lawyers from the NAACP Inc. Fund. So there were a variety of different lawyers down there. SNCC's attitude, by the way, which is sort of controversial, was then and still is. There was a lot of issue about you know, SNCC's allowing communists, certifiably communists, to be involved in the movement. SNCC's view was, as long as they are doing what we want them to do, we don't care. And that was the attitude. Now, there were a lot of people who were sort of on the periphery of the movement who were not happy about that, but that was SNCC's view. And my petition to Federal District Court was filed by a Lawyers Guild lawyer.
Charles, you gave me permission to mention that you were arrested more than 30 times during the course of your civil rights career. Your life was at risk a couple of those times, I think. Could
That's
you
true.
Tell us a little bit about some of those experiences?
Well, one that where I really got beat around was in Columbus, Mississippi, just prior to the training session at Oxford, Mississippi, for the Freedom Summer Volunteers. That was where I really went through the Valley of the Shadows of Death. Five of us, SNCC people, were on our way to Atlanta, Georgia, late one evening, and we were stopped in a little town outside of Starksville called Mayhew Junction. And we were stopped by the State Highway Patrolman. And in that car was a white man in a suit, and there were two highway patrolmen and a white man who's later identified as from the White Citizens Council in that car. And they stopped us and accused us of trying to run a white woman off the highway. And so they took us out on the side of the highway, Highway 82, there in, just outside of Columbus, Mississippi. And the highway patrolman put his gun on the driver of our car and took him back into the woods. And after a short while, they returned. In the meantime, the other four of us were standing back there with the guy, with the highway patrolman, and the guy in the suit. As they approached us, I noticed my friend's face was bloody, and blood was running down the side of his face. He was dusty, you know, as if he had been wallowing in the dirt. And the strangest thing was that the highway patrolman was dusty, and that you could tell he had been in the dust. So as they approached us, we said, "What's the matter, man? Why are you?" He said, "This guy carried me down there and he hit me." And I said, "Well, what happened to him?" So I hit him back. And so they got back, they put us in the car, and they took us to a little town called Columbus, Mississippi, on the Alabama line. And later that evening, they took us out of the cell, one by one, and took us out and beat up on the first two guys. And, well, he'd walk up to the door and say, "Any of you niggas, one of you niggas, come here." And so we always felt that we weren't niggas, but we were going to kind of play. And he said, "If you don't come, I'll come in there and get one of you." So one of our friends go to the door, come back, his face swole up and everything. Another one gone out. Then the next time when they come back, they didn't have to wait. We had decided that we were going to just walk up. So I steps up, takes me out to the back of the jailhouse. The Tom Bigby River is running down there. And when we go out the back, he said, "The river is high tonight, nigga." And so one highway patrolman was on my right side, one was on my left, and there was a sheriff's deputy standing in front of me. And so he asked me, the patrolman said, "Why did you all try to run that white woman off the street?" And I said, we didn't try to run no white woman off the street. We haven't seen it." And this guy hauled off and bust me in the side of my face with his fist and knocked me over toward this highway patrolman. And then this other one hits me and I moved back. And then he said, the guy standing in front of me, the deputy said, "Are you a nigger?" I said, "No." Boom, he hit me in my gut, and as I was bending over, hit me again. And the highway patrolman standing on the right side said, "Nigga, ain't you a nigga?" And I said, "No, what?" Both sides. And then when they stopped hitting me and I was stood back up straight, the guy standing in front of him said, "You a nigga, ain't you? Ain't you a nigga? Ain't you a nigga?" And I looked at him, and then I look at this guy over here, and I look at them. They're both big, tall highway patrolmen. You know, I'm only 5 feet six, and these big. I look around, and I look at this guy standing in front of me, and he says, "You a nigga, ain't you? Ain't you a nigga?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Get your ass back up them stairs." So then he brought the others out, the other, and beat them up. And then the next morning, early the next morning, this is where we now, we had talked about it that night, said, "Look, they're going to kill us." So the next morning, two highway patrol cars shows up, and they put two of us in the back seat of one, and they took the other in the other car, and they drive off. Headed out into the woods, out in a road, gravel road, and we just know now that this is it. This is it. So that we had already talked it over that we were not going alone. That somehow we were going to get hold to some of these guns, because they were really what we had noticed about them. They really never tried to shield the guns from us. They never. You know, they just walked right in among us, you know, this superior attitude, you know, this supremacy over us. And they never thought that we might, so we had picked out that we were going to get one of the guns. But anyway, they got us out there in the woods, and there was a white man in a robe, a robe from home, not a judge robe. They took us in front of, he's sitting at this desk, and he says, "Okay, what are we going to do with them?" A phone call came, and what we had established was that whenever we left our base of operation, we left the word where we were going and the route that we were going to take. So we had already done that. Now it's 2 days later. And the SNCC office in Atlanta is now tracing back. And so they contact Jackson. And they said, well, they wasn't heard for after they left Greenwood. They left Greenwood last time we heard from the Greenwood. So they go to look tracing between Greenwood and Stocksville and Columbus. And so a phone call comes in, and this little guy who's sitting there, we find out later, supposed to be a justice of the peace, answers the phone, and then he calls the patrolman into the back. And when they come out, they said, "You all are charged with trying to run the white woman off the highway, and your fine, your bond rather, is $104. And that's all of us together had put up in the jailhouse that night, what was in our pockets, and it was $104. And so they got us into the car and took us back to the jail, and they let us go. Of course, we journeyed on to Atlanta. They had also taken our car and put it in the impound, and we were going to have to pay a fee to get it out. So when we learned where the car was, we went there, and the black people who were working there, some men, they told us that we were going to have to pay for the car. And so we don't have no money, so what are we going to do? We're going to have to try to get to a phone. And so the black people there let us have the money to get the car out. And we went on to Atlanta. Of course, we then went to the FBI and to the Justice Department in Atlanta and reported that. And then we went on from there to Oxford, to the training session. Of course, later we filed a lawsuit, and these people were brought before a federal judge, and of course we lost the case.
So where was the federal law enforcement protection?
That summer, there was none. We were, one of the things that we were told at the training session, people may know the name John Doerr. John Doerr was like the third highest, certainly in the Civil Rights Division. I think he was right under a guy named Nicholas Katzenbach. John Doerr is famous because after Medgar Evers was murdered, there was almost, and I don't know if Charles was there, but almost a riot during the parade in Jackson. And John Doerr is famous for trying to intercede at that parade. But he was also the one who knew how far the federal government would go, and he came out to Oxford, Ohio. And he was part of the training session because of letting us know what the lay of the land was. And he specifically informed the volunteers, you cannot count, he told us, on federal protection in Mississippi. There was very clear from J. Edgar Hoover on down. J. Edgar Hoover did not like the movement, was very reluctant to get involved, and any protection we got was by volunteer lawyers who came down and assisted us. And then the law, which was, again, the law allowed us to prevent prosecutions of the worst kind by removal into district court. The major federal involvement that summer came when there was as the project wanted to do, create the publicity about what Mississippi was all about. So after the Mickey Schwerner and James Chaney and Andrew Goodman, and mind you, Andrew Goodman was like me. I mean, he had been in Mississippi no more than 10 hours and he was dead. He was just like me, a volunteer, come down. He lived in New York. He had never been to Mississippi before. Mickey Schwerner was hated in Meridian because he had a sort of a cocky sense of humor. And the white community couldn't stand him. He was a Jewish guy from Brooklyn, you know, wise guy. And James Chaney was a kid growing up in Meridian, just, you know, who was interested in getting involved. So when these guys disappeared, the publicity became pretty intense. And finally, Lyndon Johnson called Hoover in and said, you either are going to find these bodies and find them fast, or you're not going to be FBI director any longer. And what happened is that the FBI sent in hundreds of agents, and they sent in the United States Navy. And the United States Navy, they had these corps of naval sailors who were on land, but there was lots of swamps and bayous in Mississippi, so they had the equipment to handle the swamps and bayous. And they went literally marching through the swamps and bayous. Eventually, they found the bodies that weren't in the swamps. They were in this earthenware dam. But along the way, they found 8 other bodies, which was significant in Mississippi that, you know, rivers were, it's like where Emmett Till ended up in the Tallahatchie River. There were bodies that were found that were unrelated, or who knows how it had happened. But federal involvement in terms of actually us, the volunteers, or Charles, the experienced staff, that didn't exist.
Let me pose one last question, and then we have about 15 minutes to open it up to the audience for their questions. But I would like to ask each of you to tell us what you consider to be the lasting achievements or effects of the Freedom Summer Project of 1964. What endures?
Well, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge in Atlantic City brought us to the White House. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the seating of the regular white delegation to the Democratic Party National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964. That President Lyndon Johnson, who had become president, as you know, as a result of the death of Kennedy, and he now wanted a full 4-year term. So when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party brought Fannie Lou Hamer before the Credentials Committee, and Fannie Lou Hamer spoke there to the Credentials Committee, the media was carrying this. And Lyndon Johnson had them to stop it. Well, he came on TV with really nothing to say, but he was trying to make sure that Fannie Lou Hamer's speech was not getting out to the nation. But the news media had already recorded it, and that night they ran it over and over and over. And Lyndon Johnson now feared that he would lose his southern base, which he never really had, felt that these southerners, the Dixiecrats they called themselves, would not support him for his nomination. So he offered us a compromise. The Mississippi, I was a delegate to the front representing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. There were 68 of us, and Fannie Lou Hamer, who was our spokesperson there, when they came and offered us this compromise, we rejected it. What they offered us was two seats at large, and really no place, nothing, because we had gone to Atlantic City to claim the seats, to unseat and claim the seats that the Mississippians held. And we had support from several New Orleans delegations. So what we really wanted was a floor fight. When the rolls are called and so many votes for this state and that state. But we didn't get that because Lyndon Johnson, the Democratic Party accepted Lyndon Johnson by acclamation that year. And so the fight didn't take place. But what it did was we got out of that was a promise by the National Democratic Party that they would not see a segregated delegation in the future. And that also opened up the Democratic Party more democratically because now the rules and regulations were put in place that allowed for more women and more people, a more diverse Democratic Party delegation that year. So that opened some opportunities there that in 1968, you know, the regular Mississippi delegation came back just as it did before, and they were unseated, and a group representing the MFDP and a group called the Loyalists was seated. That opened up the political, changed the political landscape, really, of the nation. Republican and the Democratic Party both started to involve more. The second thing was we got the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Chris, how did your Freedom Summer experience change you?
Well, it first of all, the Mississippi changed. I think there were three things. Mississippi changed. It changed the trajectory of my life so that I have always chosen to live in multiracial settings. My family is a multiracial family. My commitments, just in terms of how I think about my life, are long-term, still involved in education, so that I engage almost every week in reading to preschool kids in a school that's practically all minority kids. And I feel that, you know, that in a way that I was a participant in something bigger than me. So I went back to Mississippi in 2004, and I was for a reunion. And so I flew to Memphis, rented a car, drove across the line. I had a brief that I had to get in, and I was making the corrections on the brief. And then I had to stop at a hotel to have the brief faxed back to my office and to be sent into an arbitrator. I do labor employment law with a wonderful firm of attorneys, many of whom are in this room. And I walk into the hotel, and it's a Drury Inn. We all know in St. Louis, this is the home base of the Drury chain. And I walk in, and this is in Mississippi, Holly Springs, which ironically is also where my grandfather was born many years ago. And a hotel behind the counter is this elegantly dressed black woman, and there's an African-American family registering at the hotel, and they're in front of a line with a white family there, and I look over to the pool, and it's there are multiracial people swimming in the pool. I can tell you, in 1964, that would have been unheard of in Mississippi. Then I drive down the road, and there's this, it's kind of kitschy, but there's this Mississippi State visitor. You know, all these states have your opening, your visitor center. And I go in, and it's like the Elvis Presley vision of a plantation. And you know, if you've ever been to Graceland, you know it's like a squished plantation. But this is Mississippi's version of it. And I go in, and behind the counter, everybody greeting me, most of them are African-American. Now, this is Mississippi's statement to the world. The pamphlets recognized Mississippi's past. They were not all, this is a honky-dory state, everything's lovely. And I go to Indianola, and the Mississippi Department of Archives is recognizing three of the major spots in Indianola in which significant events in civil rights history occurred, including the Freedom School in which I taught, which had been firebombed right after I left. So right after I left Mississippi, that school was blown up by, crop dusters. They would fly over and they'd drop firebomb on the school. So Mississippi was recognizing this place. The archivists from the Mississippi Department of Archives were there. And it turns out, because I'm a history guy, and if you see out in the outside the room, you'll see some of the stuff I kept. I brought the stuff that I had, like all these stuff from the Mississippi Project, and these archivists were from the state of Mississippi were pretty impressed. And so I said, well, look, this is all going to rot if it's not well cared for. So I deposited all that to the archives, and I asked them to send it to some other places. So I'd say that, in a profound way, what's happened in Mississippi is it's joined the country. In other words, what it is we have lots of warts in this country, lots of problems, lots of issues, racial, economic, and otherwise. But what you don't have is the perverse situation in which you're against the law all the time because the law is not so arbitrary anymore. So as you said, Jim, there's still rank poverty, problems of education, but the law is not twisted and perverse. And I think that's important, and I think it's a wreck. And then I think the fact that you can go there, and then Betty Thompson is in the House of Representatives from the Delta area. Ms. Thompson is head of the House Committee on Homeland Protection, whether you like that or not, but he is the chairman. So here's a guy, an African-American guy, who's like high up there, kind of like John Stennis was in the old days. I think those are important achievements.
Thank you, Chris and Charles. If you have 10 more minutes of energy, we want to give our audience a chance to pose any questions that they may have, and it looks like there will be several. Would you mind using the microphone?
I just wanted to ask a clarification question because I think I may have misunderstood something that you said, Chris. You were talking about when they were dredging the swamps looking for the bodies of the civil rights workers that they found other bodies. What did you say? Did you say that there were 800 bodies?
No. They found eight. 800, no.
Eight? They found eight other bodies. I had not been aware of that, which I don't know why that information is not more well known.
I suspect because they couldn't identify who the body, couldn't link the bodies to any, or to an event. I suspect that's it.
Other questions?
First of all, on behalf of myself, my family, the people here present, our community, and our country, thank you so very much, Mr. Woodard, Mr. Nelson, Mr. McGuire, Mr. Green, for all you've accomplished on our behalf and all the suffering you've gone through. One of the things I was wondering was, for the people in the Delta who are so much at the mercy economically and politically and legalistically, how are you able to motivate these people to go up there and take a chance on trying to, knowing that they're not going to get a chance to vote, how were you able to motivate them when they knew that there'd be so much reprisal? What were you able to do or say to have these people step out of their private security and into a situation where they and their family and their community were at risk?
Well, it was very hard, you know. Between 1962 and 1965, very few people got registered to vote because of the fear, because of the economic conditions, the lack of educational. But what we were able to do once the in the Delta, we started to take numbers of people to the courthouse. As a result of the food distribution, the federal food distribution was discontinued by LaFleur County, which is one of the larger counties in the Mid-Delta. And that brought people who were living on the plantations into Greenwood to us, to the SNCC office. We had Dick Gregory, comedian Dick Gregory, come down, bring food down. We set up food distribution centers in Greenwood, in Ruleville, and several other communities. Although the fear was still there, we were able to encourage a significant number to come down to the courthouse. And that in Greenwood brought out the police, brought out the dogs, jailings. So, they say that the way to get us out for something is to have a fight or a funeral. And there was kind of a fight because the dogs were sicked on local folk. And so it kind of made people now feel a little bit like coming to the courthouse. And also, when we distributed the food, we would ask them to make an application to us for it so that we could set up the family size and everything. But we'd ask them, please go to the courthouse and make an application, whether you can read or write or not. Go down, make an application, and make your X. And we stationed a person near the door to sign that person's name. Now, John Doerr, who we had mentioned earlier, sanctioned that. He said he got the Justice Department to order the clerk in the LaFleur County, Sunflower County, several Mid-Delta County, to maintain these applications if they made their ex and was witnessed. So we're building a case. So we were able to tell people that this, that something's going to be done. We're going to do something. And we ran our own candidates, set up our own election, registered blacks, and came out of that with over 90,000 people who we told the Justice Department who would have registered had it not been for the violence and discrimination. So very few people got registered, but we were able to make a case by most of these folk coming and wanting to do something because the man had used them all these years. Now he's just running them off. It was tough.
In comparison with the voter registration problems then, how do you compare them today? Are there any voter registration problems in the areas that you worked in 50 years ago?
After we got the Voting Rights Act and federal registrars were sent in to those counties that just refused to register people on the normal basis, we did register voters and elected our first member of the Mississippi Legislature in 1967. And Fannie Lou Hamer, in a lawsuit, Hamer versus Campbell, we were able to get a couple of elections set aside and re-registration and opportunity for blacks to run as candidates. But today, what we even though we can go and register without any problems, we feel that the loss of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is going to play a significant role in hereafter as to how we will be able, how many people will be able to get out to register to vote, because they are asking now for ID, photo IDs. Who knows? If you remember, there were several states in the South who talked about seceding from the Union. Now, anybody who would think that's possible and would throw that kind of thing out there may do anything down the road.
You know that was a loaded question.
By the way, Mississippi, which is interesting, because I read about this and I had heard about the Mississippi Secretary of State. Mississippi's enacting a voter ID law, but unlike Missouri, which is even more backward than Mississippi on this issue, really truly is. The Secretary of State in Mississippi was smart enough when he, you know, he didn't control the legislature. They just went off and did their own thing. But he realized that if they didn't put in some protections in Mississippi, that they'd set themselves up for a lawsuit. So he said, I'll do everything. I'll get a car. He is making it possible so that to removing the burdens to getting an ID. So there'll be no costs, as I understand in Mississippi, to getting it, because he's smart enough to know that if you make those costs prohibitive, you know, even though Section 5 doesn't exist, the Justice Department has challenged those under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution and the 15th Amendment. Missouri doesn't seem to be that smart, because Missouri, though they say you can get your ID for free, in order to, I'm not saying this, this is what Jason Kander said, who's very upset about this. Jason Kander being our Secretary of State, he said that our guys down in Jefferson City have set it up so that, well, you can get your ID for free, but you have to find, you have to go and prove, even though you may have been known by the local registrar, you may have voted there for 20 years in a row. If you don't have that state official ID, you're not going to be allowed to vote. In order to prove that, you're going to have to get a birth certificate or something like that. You're going to have to take the time to get that person. You have to pay somebody. You may not even know, you know, what the quality is. I know some people in rural areas just are not able to do it. Women who go through a divorce are going to have problems because of name changes. So it's a huge problem in Missouri that apparently in Mississippi, you wouldn't, you know, there's a phrase. This should reverse it, but the phrase in Missouri has been, and Mike Wolf, who ran for the state attorney general, found this out when he was down in southwestern Missouri. He said, a Republican legislator said to Mike, you know, Mike, you don't understand Missouri. Without Kansas City and St. Louis, you got Arkansas. Now, I would say Missouri ought to take that back and rethink what it's saying. My experience in Missouri is the Boot Hill and certain parts of that outstate area are had less of a confrontation with civil rights issues than Mississippi, and are therefore, they don't have this problem. It's cotton country down in the Boot Hill, folks. And it is, as I don't say backward, more backward in my view than Mississippi.
Other questions?
My voice holds out. This has been very fascinating, and I was certainly cheering you folks on from afar back in the day. But just recently, I've been at the other courthouse in St. Louis, I'm joking, at the old courthouse, and learned how this whole situation of having to fight to be able to vote, even if you're a citizen, came about because it happened out of a case from St. Louis, the Virginia Minor case of 1872, the Supreme Court separated out citizenship from voting. And I wondered how that played out in between. I assume I'm in a room of legal historians who can explain that to me, and perhaps others who haven't put two and two together, as I didn't do until I went and heard that talk by Bob Moore, the historian, at the old courthouse.
I have to take a pass. I don't know. My experience is more with Mississippi than the case that you're talking about, so you'll have to talk to some legal scholars in this room other than me.
I certainly cannot answer.
You stumped them.
Well, let me give you my email when you find out. Okay. I'm Laura
Maybe
X.
You'll find out before us.
Yeah. Well, again, Bob Moore at the old courthouse is the expert. I'm Laura X at the SBCGlobal.net, and I'm founder director of the Women's History Library in Berkeley, California, and we have donated our collection to UMSL, so I can also be found there.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yes.
I think my voice carries.
Okay, go ahead.
You had indicated, or you were talking about how, like, today's legislators in Missouri with the voter ID, et cetera, and so we're talking about, relatively speaking, elder statesmen. I have a high school daughter who shared with me the other day that there seems to be a disturbing trend among high school, college age young men that the South will rise again. What can we do as average citizens to change the mindset of these of the younger generation who seem to be getting sucked into, you know, what could be the elder statesman point of view? What can we do to change that?
Well, Charles and I are going to be speaking at a high school on the north side, Northwest Academy of Law. My view is that I'm not a person of nostalgia. I don't believe in nostalgia about the past, and I don't believe political movements do well with that. So I think what you're trying, I think you have to rely on history, talking to people. You have to rely on, you know, some basic empathy, you know, hopefully seeing, you know, walking in another man's footsteps. And then if you can do that, you try and figure out measured steps that you can. And I think that's the big thing about the Mississippi Summer Project. It had very concrete goals that were measurable and attainable. And I don't, you know, you didn't know they were attainable, but at least they were objective and concrete. And I think political movements do well by figuring out they figure out what they want, they figure out if it's attainable, and then they go about trying the steps to get there. Because without that, you're engaged in some sort of messianism that doesn't have any sense of, you know, reality. And without those small steps that are measured, you don't have a sense of success. And you need to have, any political movement needs to have a sense of success, step by step, in order to get you to make the next step. That's sort of how I, that's my read on it.
I'd just like to say that, are these young people talking about reliving the Civil War, or are they talking about the South rising economically, politically? How do you see what they're talking about?
Well, you know, I'm not a part of what my daughter sees with some of these other students. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I think it's, you know, about segregationism again, from the little snippets that I've been able to glean from what she's sharing with me. And she's disturbed by it. You know, she's sharing her beliefs and her thoughts and her values with this group. But she was sharing with me the other day that she's just noticing it seems to be a bigger trend that she's comfortable with. And again, since we're talking about a younger mindset, I'm just wondering what we can do to, you know, change these minds of this younger generation.
Well, we're going to have to work on them. That's, you know, education, organizing, try to help change it some, because there ain't no going back. You know, as one of my friends told me when the electricity was out, he said, we're not going to start burning lamps.
Good afternoon. I keep hearing that the issue of race is the hard conversation that America does not want to have. But I believe that platforms such as this really opens the conversation. I myself have been involved for many years, and I've never felt such a comfortable setting and just being very open about the historical content of what has happened and what has brought us to this point. And I would just say that in each of our homes, we have to encourage open conversation about what is happening here in America, what it has done to us as a people, and what it has done to us as a country, and where it will end up leading us as a country if we don't end up having that hard conversation.
So real, so real. You know, Dr. King said something that was very important. He said, we fear each other because we don't know each other. We don't know each other because we are separated from each other. We don't communicate. We don't talk.
You guys fought so hard to get people to register and vote. How come people aren't registering and voting today in the community?
Well, in Mississippi, we did do a good job. And when we started out in 1964, there was not a single black elected official in the state except for a little town called Mountain Bayou, which was an all-black community. And today we have more black elected officials in Mississippi than any state in the nation. That's not to say that all the problems are solved. You know, we could send a few of them home. But I think what we have kind of done was created a climate out there where there are white, we're electing some white people to office, even in 60 and 70% of black communities. We had no desire to just eliminate white people. We just wanted them to come around to realize that we were there.
I just think apathy is a problem. I mean, yeah, it's pretty obvious if you look at St. Louis and people don't vote. I think you had to convince people what people pay the price to vote. Out there, there's a photograph in the lobby. This is another rule I violated my parents. By this time, it was too late. I'd already been arrested 3 times, so it didn't matter. I don't know how I found this out, but I met a woman who needed to get driven to the polls. Again, she had already decided, so I wasn't persuading her to register. I was just driving her to the polls. That was sort of another lawyer's distinction. So I drove her there. Well, this, and as I say, there are pictures of her both coming to the courthouse out there and leaving the courthouse. And you can't tell it necessarily by the photographs, but this particular lady had polio as a child. And she was so poor, she didn't have crutches. She had these like leather braces on her legs. And she went up those courthouse steps. She said, honey, you don't help me. I'm going up on my own. And she went up those steps on her knees, one step at a time. And it was the one time that the white folk, the courthouse had two entrances, white and black, or white and they call it colored. And she so shamed the people running the courthouse that, because I opened the door, the main door, and they didn't stop her. And she went down that hallway on her knees, registered to vote. And her statement was, well, they can't do anything more to me than they've already done. But my point is, this was a person who took a great risk for something. And I always like to talk about her to people who don't vote, who don't have that. And I just say to people, if you don't vote, you're responsible for what you get. Don't complain. It's a waste of your time. I mean, we can talk about all the problems, why voting has its limitations, but that's what I would say.
Other questions? We know that Chris is still actively engaged in the practice of law. Charles, I think our audience might be interested to know what occupies your time these days. What are you doing?
Well, I'm a retired assistant public works director for the city of Indianola after 19 years. And I'm now involved with a group in Jackson, Mississippi called Veterans of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. Chris mentioned about the Freedom Trail markers and in the schools, in the communities. I'm doing tours of landmarks of the civil rights movement with colleges and universities who contract with me during the year around the Delta to places where the action took place. We're putting these markers in, and of course the state of Mississippi, as you may have read, is building a civil rights museum paid for by the state of Mississippi. So I'm lecturing, retired, and having a good time.
Anything else? Well, please join me in thanking our guests for this presentation today. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Charles. We appreciate it very much. Token of the court's appreciation for your appearance today and the interesting presentation that you prepared for and delivered today, we have this certificate of appreciation for Chris.
Thank you.
And for Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So it's not our prison number.
Turn sideways.
Wow.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.